I wrote trust up at the top and a couple lines down from that. One line goes to the word faith, and the other one goes to statistics. So this earlier in the week, I was listening to a message Brother Clint had at Guthrie about divine healing. And I was thinking about trusting the Lord for things that happen to our bodies. And got to thinking about this word trust. And trust is a level of confidence we put in something based on either statistics or faith. And our Sunday school lesson this morning laid a pretty good foundation for that. It was about having faith in God. And as I was thinking about the message that Brother Clint had, I was thinking about, we can gather all kinds of statistics to try to prove a point. And we prove a lot of points with statistics. We gather statistics from the past, and it's one of the reasons that we get polled by political parties about how we're going to vote or who we voted for or how we view a particular position or whatever. They're looking for statistics, and they're trying to predict how the outcome of an election will happen by the statistics that they have gathered. Trust is a basis of predicting, either percentage-wise or number-wise. Brother David mentioned in Sunday school that we trust our automobiles to get us here in the morning. And I would say that every one of us, if we went out this morning and put our key in or pushed the button or whatever it took to make our car start, if we did what we did yesterday to make it start and it didn't start this morning, every one of us would be disappointed. There's not a one of us that would say, oh, well, we've got another one, we'll drive it. If we did and we got here, in the back of our head, it'd be, I wonder what's wrong with my car, because I've been trusting this thing. Trust is what causes you to submit a 5-star review on Google. I don't know if I've ever done that yet, but a lot of you younger generation may possibly have done that. Trust can be based on faith or belief. You know, our money still says, in God we trust. In God we trust. And I'm glad it does. I think there was been kind of a move to take that off, and it got struck down. I'm thankful for that. I'm thankful at least the money says, in God we trust, whether the people believe that or not. And you might go into a business that has a sign up that says, in God we trust, all others must pay cash. You ever seen that sign? There's a sense of confidence still yet today that's still alive in our country about trusting in God. There is something that brings a calmness to that, to people's mind, to think that others trust in God. And, you know, I'm thankful to have had trustworthy vehicles, for the most part, down through life, because I know what it's like to, in my, you know, this is kind of strange, but my parents and my wife's parents both bought a Chrysler Newport. My parents was a 75, and I think hers was a 74 or 75. It's kind of strange that our parents both had kind of the same car, and both of us had similar experiences. They would always start at the house, well, most all the time. And we would go shopping. When I was too small to hardly know a wing nut from a lug nut, we would go shopping, and when we would get finished with shopping and go to get in the car to come home, the starter, if you knew the starter on those, they sounded like they were cranking 100 miles an hour and it wouldn't start, right? I don't know how many times that we went to Walmart. Walmart was really, really new then for you younger people, and our Magic Mart. We had one of them in the town where my mother shopped, and we'd come out and put the stuff in the car and go to start, and it wouldn't start. And that was very distressful to my mother, and it was very distressful to her mother. And so it's not, you know, a vehicle that won't start is, you're not going to say in Chrysler Newports we trust. You're just not going to say that. You might, we say in God we trust, but not in Chrysler Newports, not 75. So I'm thinking this morning about what we build our trust on. You know, if the statistics said, if my parents and her parents have had a good experience with that car, I would tell you a different story today. It would be something that was, oh, it's such a wonderful old car that my parents had. No, that's not the way it was. It was the other way around. Well, statistics is what drove that, because the odds were, when we drove those cars, my parents drove that car anywhere, the odds were when we got ready to go, it wouldn't start without raising the hood and tinkering on something a little bit. You had to fiddle with the choke or do something under the hood to get it to run again. Well, statistics on marriage tell us something too, don't it? There's lots of statistics out there, and the statistics for getting married is not very good. And you know what comes out of that? People aren't very trusting about marriage. And as time has went on, and this has been a very prevalent reality in my age, in my lifetime, that people have begun to be so untrusting in marriage that they won't get married. They go on and cohabitate in a manner that is not scriptural, and they don't want to get into marriage because they don't trust it. The statistics tell them that there's a better than a 50% chance that it won't last. So why would you get into something? Why would you drive a car that over half of the time it wouldn't start? Why would you agree to a long-term relationship that's supposed to last for a lifetime if it didn't? Why would you do that? So young people have got to the point that they don't trust the marriage covenant very well. It can be used to convince someone. Statistics can be. We use statistics as a leverage or persuasion tool. You can go look on somebody's mutual fund report and it says, well, statistically, over the last 5 years, it's had a this much return, 12% return or 10% or whatever it is. And so by statistics, this is a good investment. So you trust it and you invest your money in it. Those five-star reviews on Google, even if we've never submitted one, it still impacts us. How many of you have looked up a company and looked down there to see how many reviews there are? If there's one review and it's a five-star review, what does that tell you? It's like, well, there's not enough data on this one. But if there is a 4.8 on a Google review, and they've had 7,000 reviews, and it's averaged out 4.8, well, that's probably a pretty good company to do business with. If you Google a product, it could be shampoo, or it could be a part for your automobile. It could be any. And if the Google review has hundreds or thousands of reviews, and they're up there close to five, you think, wow, this is my part. This is my product. This is the thing that I want. So whether we've ever submitted a Google review or not, the five-star means something to us. And if you're really looking for things that could go wrong, you sort the reviews to see who gave it a one-star review, right? We all do that. And we look to see if anybody says, if they had a zero, I would have given them a zero. That's what we're looking for. And what went wrong? You know, was it, did it come in the box broke, or did it fail the first day that I tried to use it? I'd like to look at a story in the Old Testament in 1 Samuel, the 13th chapter. And I want us to notice how statistics impacted this group of people. 1 Samuel, the 13th chapter, it's talking about Saul and the first part of his reign as king. I'm going to read several verses here, beginning in verse 1 of chapter 13 of 1 Samuel. It says, Saul reigned 1 year, and when he had reigned 2 years over Israel, Saul chose him 3,000 men of Israel, whereof 2,000 were with Saul in Michmash, and one in Mount Bethel, and 1,000 were with Jonathan in Gibeah of Benjamin, and the rest of the people he sent every man to his tent. And Jonathan smote the garrison of the Philistines that was at Geba, and the Philistines heard of it, and Saul blew the trumpet throughout all the land, saying, let the Hebrews hear. And all Israel heard say that Saul had smitten the garrison of the Philistines, and that Israel also was in abomination with the Philistines, and the people were called together after Saul to Gilgal. So the setting here is that Saul had a small little army with him, and Jonathan had a smaller group of men with him, and Jonathan was Saul's son and seemingly a very courageous man, as we'll find out a little later on. But they attacked their enemies. And at this point in the history of the Israelites, they were under subjection to the Philistines, to the point that the Philistines wouldn't let them have a blacksmith among them. It was illegal to have a blacksmith because they didn't want anybody that could make a sword. They didn't want anybody that could sharpen a blade of any kind. And if they had any kind of tool to work the ground that needed to be repaired or sharpened, they had to take it down to the Philistines to find a blacksmith to work on it. That's just the way they were. That'd be in a pretty bad and a controlling situation. They didn't want the Israelites making any weapons. So These men that were with Jonathan and Saul, they were, I guess they were weaponless. I'm not sure but how that was. But anyway, it said they heard that the word got out that they'd attacked one of the Philistines' garrison and overpowered it. I don't know with hose or what kind of tools they used for a weapon, but anyway, it says that Israel was had an abomination with the Philistines. I believe that means the Philistines were stirred up in opposition to them. And it says in verse 5, and the Philistines gathered themselves together to fight with Israel. Now listen to these numbers. That's what statistics are, isn't it? It's numbers. So the Philistines got together 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen, and that's the real mobile military. And then it said, and people as the sand which is on the seashore in multitude, and they came up and pitched in Michmash eastward from Bethaven. When the men of Israel saw that they were in a strait, for the people were distressed, then the people did hide themselves in caves and thickets, and in rocks and high places, and in pits. So, what happened here? Statistics dictated what they trusted in, didn't they? Before this, there was 2,000 of them that had trusted in the leadership of Saul, and 1,000 that had trusted in Jonathan. And I don't know if it meant that all of them left him, or if it meant that the people that had already been sent home went and started to hide themselves in the caves and thickets and rocks and high places and in pits. But they went into hiding because of statistics. And you know, statistics will either increase our trust in something or decrease our trust in something. And we can hear the statistics about failure rate of the car we drive, the roofing material that we have on our house. We could hear statistics about how many marriages fail. We could hear statistics on the gum that we might chew or the food we eat. And it's going to impact us as to what we trust or what we do with that. And statistically here, it impacted these Israelites to the point they were in a terrible state of trusting God. If they had money of their self, do you think they would have put in God they trust, in God we trust on it? If they did, it was a hoax because they were trusting in statistics. You know, we can get a word in a diagnosis for a physical ailment, and statistically, it can bring fear on us, can it? You could hear the word cancer. And statistically, we don't even have to know the numbers for the type of cancer we have, if we got it. We just hear the word cancer, and immediately we think of statistics, don't we? Statistically, cancer is not in the same category as a common cold, is it? It's not in the same category as a sprained ankle. It's not even in the same category as a toothache. Statistically, cancer usually equates to a terminal illness in all of us. I mean, all of us here, if we hear the word cancer, then statistically, it brings fear, just like it did to these Israelites. We could hear another disease mentioned, and statistically, it would cause us to begin to wonder, is our trust Is our trust in God, or is our trust in something else? And I'm going to tell you, if we trust in statistics, we'll be making lots of changes in life. I've lived long enough that it's been fascinating. Some of this I kind of predicted in rashness, but it's been fascinating to see in my lifetime the things that are recommended and those that are recommended foods to eat and recommended foods to stay away from. We've went from recommending we don't eat any butter and you eat soybean oil to now it's real butter is the thing, right? I can remember when, and maybe it's still true, I don't know, but a lot of people, potatoes, you're not supposed to eat potatoes. And it's like, sorry. you know, there's a lot, not my category, so I'm not going to get very far down this path, but I just remember that it seems to always be a moving target. Somebody is pulling statistics in and interviewing somebody that lived a long time or somebody that died prematurely, and they're accumulating statistics, and they're all time changing what we ought to eat and how we ought to do this and how we ought to do that. And you're going to make a lot of changes if you only trust in statistics. So, statistically, there are, we've got to be careful, because if we're not careful, statistics will destroy what little faith we have to start with. If you feel like you have a little bit of faith, be careful. Statistics can wipe that, just scrub it plumb off. Scrub it plumb away. If we just rely on, if we only trust in statistics, it'll either inflate our ego, statistics will, or we think that we can overcome the something in our own self. If we statistically, if we hear the statistics that the people that eat collard greens recover from some kind of dietary problem, then, you know, we're probably going to eat some more collard greens. And we're going to probably think that statistically we can come out of this. And it'll inflate our ego. You know, I started eating collard greens and I started getting better, and within 6 months I was perfectly well. Well, who got the credit for that? Faith or statistics? And if we can inflate our ego, I'm not saying we shouldn't try to eat the right things and all of that. And if we just are driven on statistics, then if we feel like the man that brought his son to Jesus, and Jesus said, "If thou believe, I can make him whole." He said, "I believe. Lord, help thou my unbelief." He had a little faith, and if we're only trusting in statistics, our little faith will get scrubbed out. It'll either be scrubbed out, or we'll feel like we can do it ourselves. One of the two. I'd like to look at another place in the Bible, because faith operates in a different realm than statistics to build trust. Faith is a belief, and a belief becomes a spiritual thing. You know, you can maybe support faith or trust in God with statistics a little bit, But be careful. Statistics will probably be a worse enemy than it is a friend. So, you can say, I'm trusting the Lord to resolve my relationship issues or to give me direction or whatever it is. And if you're not careful, statistics will undermine your faith. But faith is something that is a spiritual thing, and it has to come from a belief that God is, and He's a rewarder of them that trust Him. Faith doesn't necessarily follow statistics. In fact, faith may choose a path that defies statistics. And that's why it's important. Faith is when we make a choice that's not based on statistics. It's not based on Google reviews. You ever purchase something that had no Google reviews or just had maybe 3 or 4 Google reviews, or maybe it was a 2.1 on Google reviews? You ever purchase something like that? I have. And I think that if we do, we're going to look beyond what somebody wrote about it. We have to look at the product itself. We have to look at the service itself, what it is. And we have to take into context maybe somebody else's expectations. But let's turn the page into the 14th chapter of 1 Samuel. And I want to read, we haven't changed the scenery very much, but I want to read to you something that, a decision that was made not completely completely defying statistics, okay? So you remember the setting in the 13th chapter, 6,000 horsemen, 30,000 chariots, people like the sand of the sea, and now I don't think they've left. I don't think they've went anywhere. But let's look in the 14th chapter, and we'll begin in the first verse. It says here, now it came to pass upon a day that Jonathan, the son of Saul, now this is the one that had 1,000 men with him originally, right? And I don't know, did 999 of them go and hide in a cave somewhere? Because it sounds like they're down to Jonathan and his armor bearer. So it says that Jonathan, the son of Saul, said unto the young man that bare his armor, come and let us go over to the Philistine garrison that is on the other side. But he told not his father. Why didn't he tell his father? You know, I think his father had been heavily impacted by statistics. Man, the Philistines has got people, they're just like ants over there. There's Philistines everywhere. They got 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen. People, like, they're just running out their ears, so to speak. They've got so many people there, there's no way we can stand against them. And your 1,000 men, 999 of them have left. The only one you got is your armor bearer with you. We got to hunker down and wait this out. I think that's what Saul's mentality was. His trust had been impacted by statistics. And Jonathan said to his armor bearer, we'll read more before we say this. And Saul tarried in the uttermost parts of Gibeah under a pomegranate tree, which is on Migron, and the people that were with him were about 600 men. So he had lost at least 1,400. And Ahiah, the son of Ahitub, Ichabod's brother, the son of Phinehas, the son of Eli, the Lord's priest in Shiloh, wearing an ephod, and the people knew not that Jonathan was gone. And between the passages which by Jonathan sought to go over into the Philistines' garrison. There was a sharp rock on one side and a sharp rock on the other side, and the name of the one was Bozez, and the name of the other Sinna. And forefront of the one was situate northward over against Michmash, and the other southward against Gibeah. And Jonathan said to the young man that bare his armor, "Come, and let us go over into the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us, for there is no restraint to the Lord to save by many or by few." What did Jonathan just say? "I'm not going to look at statistics. I got my eyes on something else besides 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen, and people that's just everywhere. You're the only one that's still with me, and Dad lost 1,400 of his. He only has 600 men with him right now." And he says, "It may be that the Lord will work for us. For the Lord, there is no restraint to the Lord to save by many or by few." And his armor bearer said unto him, "Do all that is in thine heart. Turn thee, behold, I am with thee according to thy heart." Then said Jonathan, "Behold, we will pass over unto these men, and we will discover ourselves unto them." In other words, we're going to go up there and get as close as we can, and then we're going to kind of ease out where they can see us. We're going to go there secretly as close as possible, and then we're going to, "And if they say unto us, 'Tarry until we come to you,' then we will stand still in our place and will not go up unto them. But if they say thus, 'Come up unto us,' then we will go up, for the Lord hath delivered them into our hands, and this shall be a sign unto us." What did he base that on? Did he have any statistics for that? Now, a garrison, how many people's in a garrison? You think more than two? I think there's more than two. It's an outpost, isn't it? There's enough men there to kind of make a little, very small army, you might say. There's some men here that they've got equipment, they've got training. There's probably some fortress around there. There's some kind of tangible defense mechanism there. What did Jonathan and his armor bearer have? Jonathan might have had a sword. What did the armor bearer have? Probably not a sword. He might have had a mattock or something that you would chop, work the ground with. He probably didn't have a sword. Maybe he was carrying a shield they had made out of something. I don't know. Maybe it was made out of wood or something. I don't know. They didn't have a lot of equipment. They didn't have any cover because they was hiding behind rocks. They went through by a sharp rock, two sharp rocks, and they get to a garrison, and you notice how they, when they approached it, it sounds like this garrison is at a higher elevation. He says, if they say, "Come on up," then we're going to go up. But he said, if they say, "Wait till we come down," then we'll wait. And both of them discovered themselves, this is verse 11, under the garrison of the Philistines. And the Philistines said, "Behold, the Hebrews came forth out of the holes where they hid themselves." You think they said this like with a real serious tone of voice? I think they were being snarky and smirky. Look at there. There's a couple of them Hebrews. They come out of the cave or the hole they've been hiding in. Wonder what they're doing. You think they're looking for food? Well, one of them looks like he might have a shield or something. Did they feel intimidated? Absolutely not. How did they respond? And the men of the garrison answered Jonathan and his armor bearer and said, "Come up to us and we will shew you a thing." What do you think they were going to do? What do you think? At least they were going to capture them. I think they were probably going to mistreat them somehow. Probably take their lives, ultimately. But they was going to have a little fun with them first. They were going to maybe, they said, come up to us and we'll show you a thing. And Jonathan said to his armor bearer, come up after me, for the Lord hath delivered them into the hand of Israel. What did he base that on? Do you have any numbers to go on? He didn't have any numbers to go on. You think this is... Now, let me just ask you something. With what I said earlier, if you was looking on some kind of used car lot and you found a 75 Chrysler Newport, how many of y'all would buy it? This lady would not buy it. And if I told her that I found a robin egg blue 75 Chrysler Newport just like my mama had, I want to buy it. She would probably really struggle with me. And she'd say, honey, I have no idea why you want something that caused you so much grief. I haven't found one. Not yet. I'm not looking, though, either. I just, for the sake of the story. But if I found one and I told her that that's what I want, I think that she would say, there's got to be something else that you would rather buy than that. It wasn't based on, there was nothing here for him to base this confidence on statistically. He didn't have any statistics that this garrison would fall to him, but he said, come up after me, for the Lord had delivered them into the hand of Israel, not just into my hand, because we have smote however many more before this. He didn't have that, but he had something else that he was trusting in. He had something that I would like to call faith. He had faith in God. And Jonathan climbed upon his hands and upon his feet. Now, how steep was this? He wasn't walking up the hill. It was steep enough that he was... I've been in some of those places where the slope was steep enough that you're reaching for roots and trees and bushes and rocks and something to get a hold of with your hand, and he went scrambling up. How capable of you are you of engaging in conflict when you're climbing up on your hands, and you're not in a position to engage in combat? In fact, you'd be in a very vulnerable situation where the enemy could attack you. You know, there are times that faith will cause us to step out and climb up and engage in when it looks like the enemy has all of the advantages. The enemy might be that bad word, that five-letter word that brings fear to all of us. It might be something else that causes us to feel so distressed. It may be have a whole bunch of statistics against it, and Saul and his men were hiding under a pomegranate tree because of the statistics. So they went climbing up, and they fell before Jonathan, and his armor bearer slew after him. Now, I don't know, I don't want to make this any more gruesome than it is, but I already told you what I thought they had for weapons. And these men, the Lord went with them. You know, the Lord caused the walls of Jericho to fall. He caused the waters of the Jordan River to stand up in a heap. He caused the Red Sea to dry up. They didn't have statistics for any of that. How many times before or since has somebody marched around a city and the wall fell down? How many other times besides the times in the scripture was it that people walked across on dry land through a body of water? Or how many times was it that a man was told he could get out of the boat and walk to Jesus? Didn't have any statistics for that, did it? He had something else. It was called faith. And that first slaughter, which Jonathan and his armor bearer made, was about 20 men. Within it were a half acre of land, which a yoke of oxen might plow. So Jonathan exhibited what? Faith. It wasn't based on statistics. It was based on a confidence in God. How do you get that? I want to tell you that if you're determined to increase your faith only by statistics, it's going to be hard to do. You can increase your faith by looking around and say, well, the Lord blessed this one, and he blessed that one, and he worked some troubles out for this person over here. So statistically, it looks like the Lord helps people. Might be in their body. It might be in their decisions. It might be in their relationships. The Lord's blessed this brother and sister or that brother and sister to have, they've been married 50 years or 60 years or whatever. The Lord has, and I believe and love the testimonies when somebody says, and everybody that says, the Lord has helped us, and we give all the credit to the Lord for helping us have 50 years together or 55 years or 60 or whatever it is. I believe that's very appropriate. And I love those statistics. And I really believe that if we will love the Lord with all of our soul, mind, and heart, that we can change the statistics in the world about marriage. I believe that with all of my heart. If two people are endeavoring to live together as a married couple and they both sincerely love the Lord and they want to be pleasing to Him, the statistics will be changed because of you. You will be a number on the right side, if you will. But if there's going to come a time that we have to have some faith that's not based on statistics if we're going to trust the Lord. It says here that Jonathan said, if they say come up, then we're going to go up. The Lord's going to deliver. He had no statistics to base that on. All he had was his confidence and his spiritual relationship with the Lord. So I ask us today, is our confidence and trust in God based on statistics? Or is it based on faith? I like it when statistics back up my decision. I like that. But I'm going to tell you, I've had to make some decisions in life that weren't based on statistics. I've had to base them on a confidence that the Lord would see me through. And the Lord would be there for me. And I believe that we have to have that. It's in a different dimension. You know, we have three basic dimensions in our world. We measure things with a tape measure. We have length and width and height. And the fourth dimension is what? It's time. So there, time is not, it don't, we don't measure time with a tape measure, do we? None of us do. We measure time with something else. And faith is measured in another, it operates in another dimension. And we cannot have faith if we're trying to measure it with statistics. That's just something I want us to get a hold of today. Faith is something that goes beyond statistics. It's in a spiritual realm that will prosper when our relationship with the Lord prospers. If our relationship with the Lord is not in good shape, it's going to be hard for us to have faith. But when our relationship with the Lord is secure and we're communicating with Him, I'm going to tell you it's easier to have faith than it is when you're not communicating with Him. I trust the Lord will take these thoughts and inspire them to your hearts, challenge you, cause you to want to have a relationship with the Lord that will foster faith. Faith like Jonathan had. It was in a very serious situation in Israel's time, in their age that they lived in. They didn't have any way, hardly, to defend themselves. It's horrible to think of how they got in that position. But right in the midst of all of that, Jonathan believed that God would help them and deliver that garrison into their hand. And I believe the Lord can inspire our faith today. You pray for me.